Before we begin, let's open with prayer. God of all of us, all over the world, we ask your special concern this morning, knowing all the violence that's taken place in Paris and in other places. We ask that somehow you soften us all, that you fill us all with your love, and show us the way to live together on this earth. We especially thank you for the life of Dr. Henrietta Greer and for her sacrifices, for her energy, for her love and care and her faithfulness. We ask you to open our eyes to the work that's before us. And we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. So, about a year and a half ago, Eric asked me if I would be willing to do a talk on Dr. Henrietta Greer, and I said, I have no idea who this person is. She was a missionary in China. I have never been to China, so I have to say that. But I have a little bit of a connection because, first of all, she was a female scientist, and I am that. She was a physician, and in her time, there weren't very many female physicians. When I was in undergraduate school in the 1960s, in my class of 60 chemistry majors, there were 4 women. So even at that time, there weren't very many women in science. I went back to school later on, and it was half and half. So nowadays, women scientists, women physicians are very common. But in her day, they weren't so much. Another connection that I have, I guess, with her is the fact that she worked as a missionary, and I have been to Haiti several times, so I don't want to say that this is at all comparable, because it's not. We have some discomfort when the power goes out and we don't have lights, or maybe we can't run something or other. Sometimes the shower's cold. Twice we slept on the airport floor. But Nettie Greer spent 4 weeks in an insect-infested boat getting there. She quite literally lived in a war zone. The area where they lived, there was great political unrest, and she had her family there, and they endured all sorts of uncertainties and discomfort and really, literally, danger. But most of all, during the time there, she lost a child and her husband to disease. So her sacrifices are really very great. Before we start, I would like to just let you know a little bit about where some of this information came from. I was able to get a book called Glorious Living that I had it through interlibrary loan, and then I was able to purchase it. I want to put in a plug for the public libraries. I went to Carnegie Library unannounced, and I had 3 staff people with me for about 2 hours helping me find stuff. So I just want to say they are great, and Upper St. Clair Library as well worked with me and helped me with a number of documents. So support your public libraries when you have a chance. So as you can see there, much of this information comes from the Presbyterian Church. I'm not a historian of the Presbyterian Church, but I think that's about 2 iterations back from where we are now, the Presbyterian Church U.S. So this book was in 1937, and it's a book about 7 missionaries, and she was one of them. Another book that I had to give back, Foundations of World Order, also about the Foreign Service of the Presbyterian Church, and I took some maps out of that. Warren Archer was kind enough to loan me 2 very heavy history books, which I did use them, and so that gave me some more information. I found a great collection of photographs of China from her era, Duke University has it. It's all digitized, so I use some of those. And then Eric Harrison provided me with quite a bit of material from the Presbyterian Historical Society. So that's where all this information comes from. Thank you, Eric, for all of that. To give you a sense of what we're going to do here, I would like to try to convey the kind of life she led, something about her character, the kind of contribution she made, what the costs were to her, and they were many, and her motivations for living this life. And it will be less about data and facts and maybe more about impressions, since I have a lot of stories about her. Some of her experiences are sad and some are joyful. Some are pretty terrifying and some are really funny. So I hope that we can get a picture of her through these. And she sees all of this as her gift to those least among us, which is means that it's a gift to God. So there she is. She's probably about 35 in that picture. She was born in Pennsylvania. So what I'm going to do here is make a timeline, and we'll add to it as we go along. But she was born in Greenville, which is about 80 miles north of here. And at age 13, she decided that she wanted to become a missionary. She had a woman came to their church who had been a missionary in Africa, and so Nettie was quite moved by that, even at that young age. Here is a slide of notes copied from her journal, and if you look at the third line down, she said, "I pledged myself to the mission field," and here she was at 13 years old. Now, I can tell you at 13 years old, I don't know what I was doing, but I know I wasn't that serious about anything, and I don't know about any of you, but she was a very mischievous child, according to her own telling, and she didn't want any of her friends to know that she was going to be a missionary. But she did do that, and she pledged herself to the mission field in 1882. She, in order to do this, she prepared herself as a teacher. That was her initial preparation. So she went to school to be a teacher. She completed that training in 1889, but she was still restless, and she had this thing about wanting to be a missionary, and she really wanted to go to Africa. So she decided that the thing that would help her to do this was if she got some skills, and the thing she felt was needed were medical. So she thought she would get some training, but she didn't know whether she wanted to be a doctor or a nurse because she really didn't know anything about it. So she went to her own physician, and she said, "What do you think? Should I be a doctor or a nurse?" So he said to her, "Just come and work in my office for 6 months, and then I'll tell you." And so at the end of the 6 months, he said, "Nettie, I really think you should be a doctor." And so she decided to do that. And a classmate wrote a letter about her and said that she borrowed this physician's Gray's Anatomy and memorized it. Now, I don't know if that's really true. That seems to me to be a daunting task. But apparently, according to her classmate, she did that before she went off to school. So she completed medical school at the Women's Medical College in New York, which I think is connected to Cornell nowadays. She lived in a boarding house. She was 24 at this point. So she lived in a boarding house there. And there was a young man that lived there also. His name was Mark Greer. And he was he finished seminary and wanted to go to be a missionary, but the church didn't have money to send him. So they didn't have money to send him until the following year. So he ended up staying in that boarding house, same boarding house as she was in, for a year, and he just took a year of medical training. So they got to know one another, but not terribly seriously. They were acquainted. So at the end of her training there, she was given an assignment to go to China. And she was pretty heartbroken because she had her heart set on Africa, because that was her first exposure to the mission field. But they said, "This is where we feel you will thrive." And at first she said, "Well, I'm not going." But then she decided to go. So she did go. She sailed for China on September 18, 1893, and got there on October 10th, so it wasn't exactly an overnight flight. So she arrived in Shanghai. Here is a map. I had some confusion, I have to say, about the Chinese names, because with every people in power, the names change. So I can't always follow from one to another. But this map here is quite an old map, and it came out of the Foundations of World Order book. And let's see, I'm told I have a... Yeah, there I am. So here's Shanghai, where she arrived. And the town that she ended up in and spent her 40 years is called Suzhoufu. And this was the only map I could find with that town on it. So it is not exactly a perfect map of China, but you can see some of the places that you recognize there. Here's Korea, here's Japan, more or less, and so forth. So she came into Shanghai. Now, let's see, here we go. This is a more current map. And the blue line there that you see is the Grand Canal. And this canal is 1,115 miles long. And I wondered about it. I just looked up some stuff about it. And I wondered, well, you know, how long it had been there. And it turned out that it's built in the year 600 or 600 and something. So this thing is really old. Further, just information-wise, the Chinese are the ones that invented the lock that we currently have today with the two ends. It's called a pound lock, and it's what's in the Panama Canal and the other canals that we know. Anyway, that's sort of beside the point, but we lived in Panama for a year, so it's sort of interest to us. In any case, she is here in Shanghai, and she needs to get to the town of Suzhoufu, which is not on this map, but it's out here somewhere. So they ride up the Panama Canal, about 300 miles of it. So they're up in the middle, and she tells a little bit about it. Apparently, this was not a pleasant trip, and I have a picture of the boat that they rode in, and this is a picture out of the Glorious Living book. So that's her boat, and I can't tell you if she... I don't know if you can see her there, but it wasn't exactly a cruise ship. A quote says, "Nearly every crack overhead was filled with roaches in all stages of development. I sat up all night until I could stand it no longer. Then I wrapped myself head and all in a sheet and finally went to sleep to dream of the millions of roaches overhead." So this is her introduction. This is she's just getting there. So let's see. Here we go. There we are. So the yellow line there shows their trip. So that's where they went from Shanghai to that end of the canal, and then she has to go overland, and this is a great adventure too. The first thing they rode on was something called a mule litter, and there you see it. The going in, let's see, how do they say it? The coming end of one donkey and the going end of the other, and then the litter is in the middle, and I gather it was rather a jiggity-joggity ride. They rode that for a week. And then they graduated to donkeys, and then finally they rode in something called a Peking cart. There you are. And these photos here are from the Duke University's China file. And there are many. As I said, there are 5,000 photographs in there, but I found these that were useful. And then they went to, after the Peking cart, the next mode of transportation was a wheelbarrow, which I had never heard of, but there they are. These people riding in the wheelbarrows, and this may be her, or this one may be. I don't know what. I think they're carrying supplies in the first one. And it turns out that if there's a good wind up, then they can attach a sail. This is not her, but I wanted to show how that worked. So they rode all these various devices and got to the town of Suzhen, and I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm guessing. But this is where she spent 3 years. So she spent 3 years there working as a physician, and at that point, she was reunited with Mark Greer, who became her husband, and they were transferred then to the town of Suzhoufu. I keep getting that mixed up. And so let's go to that. So she began work there as a physician, and they got married. So in 1896, she married Mark, and then they moved to the town of Suzhou, which is not too far away. That's about 60 miles there. From the red dot was where she lived for 3 years, met her husband, and then the two of them were transferred together to this, which is pretty much in, at that time, a very remote area. So when they first arrived there, they lived in a mud hut. It was a space that had only a stone table in the middle, and so they used that initially for their medical examination. In 1901, they were able to purchase some land. There was a treaty, and I'm not a historian here, but I did look up some of this. I wondered how they were able to do this. So they moved to Suzhou, and this treaty of Tientsin here, I have a little bit of information about it. It was between China and some of the Western countries. And this treaty allowed foreigners to own land. They could travel with a passport anywhere in the country. If they didn't have a passport, there were certain towns called treaty cities that they could go into without. This included missionaries, and the preaching of Christianity was protected by this. But, well, let's see, another. Here's a painting of that. So at that point, since they were able to buy land, they began the construction of a house. Mark, her husband, had, and I don't know how this happened, but he brought a door and a window from the United States and incorporated into their new house. So that took, I think, quite a while for them to build that house. Problem was, though, that the locals were afraid of them. They called them foreign devils. They had, of course, a different language, different customs, different food, different clothing, different religion, different skin, different features. So here is a cartoon that was sort of popular at the time, and you can see this, I think, I have no idea what this is, but I think it's propaganda. And so this is the picture of the foreign devils, and that's sort of how they were scaring everybody about them. They threw rocks at them. They spread a rumor that she was really a man masquerading as a woman because she had such big feet. And I don't know if you know, but in China, they bound the women's feet, so they were tiny. I think I have a photograph. This is another one of the Duke University photographs. And so if you look at this woman's feet, you can see how tiny they are. They don't do that anymore, but that's what they did. And of course, she had big, I don't know, size 9s or something. So they said, well, she must be a man. They also said that she captured children and cut out their eyes to make foreign medicine. It turns out that she was an eye surgeon. So there was a little bit of they got some of that information somehow and made it into that rumor. But she was not happy with this hostility, and she knew that she couldn't do her work there as long as that existed. So she and her husband decided that they would try to break it down. And by this point, they had a little baby, about 6 months old, a little girl. And so she got some Chinese clothes and dressed the baby in Chinese clothes and took her outside. So, and a crowd gathered because they wanted to see the little foreign devil. And a man asked if he could hold her. And Nettie was afraid, but her husband said, oh, sure, and handed the baby, and they passed the baby around and eventually came back to them unharmed. And so after that, they started to make some inroads. The next day, a lady named Mrs. Lee came to visit and asked her, where did you get that baby you showed us yesterday? She said, there's a notice posted out there that says that you're a man and you bought the baby in Shanghai. And Nettie said, well, it's my very own baby. And the woman said, well, if it's your baby, you have to prove it. You nurse it right now. And so she did. And so then she was believed. And it turned out that this Mrs. Lee was the first patient to come to her clinic there, and she was one of the first to be baptized, and her Mrs. Lee's son went on to graduate from seminary and returned to Suzhou to help out. So even though she was the one that was the most confrontational, it turned out to be her real ally. And so after this, the ice was broken, and she had a clinic then every day, I guess 6 days a week. Everybody wanted to see a person they called Tai Fu, which I think is Chinese for great person. So she was starting to get some, have some connection with the people there. There were a lot of eye problems, a disease called entropion, where the lid turns under and the eyelashes scratch against the eyeball, and eventually, if it's untreated, leads to an infection and blindness. But a simple surgery cures this, and she would do 6 or 8 of these a day. And so you can see how this rumor of cutting out eyes and business kind of might have gotten started when people don't really understand what's going on. Just by the way, Pastor Pierre just had this surgery, I think about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks. There was a lot of typhoid and malaria, and those the missionaries there were not immune to it. One of them came down with the diseases, and so they decided that they needed to have fresh milk. And I want to read you a little bit of the story, because not everything is deadly serious here. Some of it is fun. So they asked for a cow. And cows, they had cows in China, but they were used as a beast of burden. They towed the carts and plowed the fields and so forth. So they didn't know anything about milking a cow. And these American missionaries were not farmers, so they didn't know anything about milking a cow either. So I will read you the little excerpt here in this Glorious Living book about what happened, because I thought it was kind of funny, and it gives a sense of their life together there. So the gentleman who was ill was Mr. White. In his illness, just had to have fresh milk. How to get it was a problem, for the Chinese throughout all that region had never heard of milking a cow, that animal meaning to them only something to pull a plow or draw a lumbering cart. Finally, through their Chinese cook, the missionaries arranged with a farmer in the country to purchase a cow and a calf. The day arrived. The cook announced that the cow was awaiting their pleasure in the backyard. Mr. and Mrs. Greer went out and called Mrs. White. They there and then had a station meeting to decide on an important matter of mission policy, namely the painless extraction of milk from an unsuspecting cow. They decided at once, I mean, they don't know how to do this, you can see. They decided at once that they must resort to strategy. So they led Bossy over to a well-rooted tree and tied her head and horns to it. The four legs were tied firmly to trees or stakes, and their cook got a tug-of-war hold on her tail. Now comes the strategy. Bossy must be fooled into thinking that Bossina, the calf, was extracting the milk. So after Bossy had become more or less resigned to her lack of freedom, the calf was brought in and connected up with the dairy lunch, then disconnected, whereupon Mr. Greer, her husband, seized the opportunity and tried to get as much milk as he could. The performance was repeated again and again. A great crowd of Chinese men, mostly soldiers and children, had climbed up on the wall from the adjoining yard to witness this first-run movie. Many and naive were their remarks from the sideline, but the actors were too intent on their performance to care, and in an hour later, they had come up with 1 cup of real cow's milk to take to their sick comrade. They felt that the show was well worthwhile. There were, however, unintended consequences from this, or maybe not. Maybe it wasn't unintended. Maybe this is the kind of thing that they hoped to do. But there was a soldier in the crowd who was watching this, and his job was beating soldiers who broke the rules. And sometimes there was a housing of, like a compound of soldiers right next to their house. And his job was to beat the soldiers who disobeyed, sometimes to death. And he watched this cow event, And he became interested, and he came and started to talk to the people. And eventually, he learned of Christianity. He was converted, became a new man, gave up soldiering, and started the first dairy in that part of China. So things happen like this, and that's probably not something that they planned to have, but it was one of the things that happened. There was in the part of China a rather unsettled time in about, I guess this was about 1911, where the people started to rise up against the presence of the missionaries. They were aware of this treaty, but this sort of correlated with general worries about colonization by Western powers. Here is a cartoon that was available at the time. This is a French political cartoon, and it shows China about to be carved up by the Western powers. So you see the pizza-looking thing there is China, and these guys are all having a part of it, and the Chinese man is looking on with despair. So things were politically unsettled. They never were really that settled, but this is the time, the beginning of something called the Boxer Wars, and you may know, it's 1900, I think I said the wrong time. So let's see, go here, and so in my little timeline here, you can see here come the Boxer Wars in the year 1900. The Boxers, the name of their proper name was the Righteous and Harmonious Fists, a secret society that arose in that area. But the American missionaries were the ones, they think probably, that first referred to them as Boxers because of the martial arts and calisthenics that they practiced. And the Boxers imagined that they had supernatural powers. And part of this was a response to what China was viewing as colonization. There was lots of killing and looting, and these missionaries were right in the middle of it. So here is a sketch of the Boxers, the Society of Righteous and Harmonious Fists. And there was, sometimes it's called the Boxer Wars. There were, I forgot to write down the number, a large number of people killed, and over 100 of them were Christian missionaries, and lots of Christian people. And they were unhappy about what they viewed as Christian colonization. They set fire to houses. They burned churches. So it was not a good time. There was a drought in the area at this time, and so some Chinese blamed the missionaries. So they wrote a little poem here. This came out of Warren Archer's book. Actually, there was a first verse that I didn't write down because it was pretty crude, so I'm only giving you this one. It says, "No rain comes from heaven. The earth is parched and dry, all because the churches have bottled up the sky. When at last all the foreign devils are expelled to the very last man, the great Qing," this is the Qing dynasty, "united together will bring peace to this our land." What did I do? Does it still work? Okay. Did I sneeze? I don't know. Well, anyway, so this was a very unsettled time, and they, it turned out that there was a young Chinese telephone operator who Dr. Greer had treated for scarlet fever, he and his family, and so they felt that she had saved his life, and he interrupted an early warning telegraph about the Boxers coming to their town, to Suzhoufu. And so he passed this on to the missionaries, told them to leave immediately. They hesitated until they saw chalk rings over the door, a sign that they had been marked for killing. So he provided them carts. This is a Chinese guy now. And they took their family and their cook 80 miles to a town on the river where they thought they would meet up with their fellow missionaries, but they had all gone. They hid in an old inn for the night. Their cook hired a boat to Shanghai, and they went down the canal to Shanghai. But the story goes that every time they had to stay in the middle of the river because if they got too close, people would throw rocks at them. And when they went under the bridges, people would pelt them with rocks. So that they were not loved at that time. They once they got to Shanghai, they went to China. They went to Japan. They sailed to Japan, stayed there for a year. While they were there, they both taught, and when they at the end of the year, they were both offered double their salary if they would stay, but they felt called to go back to China. So back they went. And this seems to happen a fair amount. There are things that upset, they leave, and then they always come back because she really feels that this is her calling. Part of her work there was to receive visitors, and people were always coming in and hanging out and talking to her. One day, this is a sad story. So one day, a woman stayed really too long, and her son was ill at the time. Finally, and she kept saying, I don't think she's ever going to leave. I don't think she's ever going to leave. But she finally did leave. She went to examine her little son and found that he had quite a fever. The next day it worsened, and she suspected he had diphtheria. There was an antitoxin available, but the clinic there was out of it, so they didn't have any. So they sent word to a neighboring mission, and a runner was sent there for 60 miles. He didn't make it in time, and the little boy died. So she lost actually her only son. She had three daughters and a son. So this town where they were, it seems like there's always something going on politically, and it's never a very happy time in that regard. But this, up until 1912 was this Qing dynasty, and they had an emperor and all. So it was pretty remote, and they didn't really know all that much about what was going on in the country, but they had a sense that something was wrong, and so again they got the word to evacuate, and they said, well, you know what, we're not going to go because Mr. Greer was sick. He began to take ill, and there were two new groups of missionaries coming up the canal, and they said, well, we will just hang out for a while. So finally they got a telegram saying, get out, and so they did. They left. And there's a story about them having great difficulty on a train because during this time all of the windows were out of the train. It was winter. There was cold air blowing in. But they finally made it, and they got back down to Shanghai, and they stayed a year there. So when she was in Shanghai, she took a correspondence course. Actually, she took three correspondence courses, one in tropical medicine, one in laboratory diagnosis, and one about parasites. I wondered how that happened, she did that. Couldn't do it on the internet, but I guess they actually sent it by mail. But in any case, she didn't have much free time. When she did the one on parasites, she ended up spending 6 hours a day over a microscope. So there wasn't a lot of time for her to have a tea party. Another story I would like to tell. This one I call the Surprised Bandit. This just kind of gives you a sense of her character. One night when her husband was ill, about 2 a.m, she woke up and saw a man in the room with a gun. She jumped out of bed, grabbed him by the throat, and said, "What do you want? Why are you here?" She chased him out of the room, down the stairs. He got confused, ran back up the stairs, ran into the room with, at that point they had all the children, the little girls. They started screaming. The man got so frightened he dropped the gun, jumped out through the window, off the porch, and over the fence and ran away. So they were safe, but their house had been invaded, so they reported it to the magistrate and discovered that the bandit was one of the general's soldiers. So the magistrate didn't know what to do. You know, he had the foreigners here that he was trying to take care of. He had the general here that he didn't want to offend. If you offend the general, they said it's like pulling on the tiger's whiskers. So he didn't want to do that, so he didn't do anything. But that left them feeling unprotected, so they contacted the general themselves. The general moved all the soldiers out of the building next to their house and offered the property to the mission for a very low price. And this is how they came to have the land on which to build the hospital, which they had been eyeing for 20 years. So a new hospital was built, and here is a photograph of the hospital, and you can see that person outlined in red there is Nettie and her other parts of her family and some of the Chinese people there as well. Let's see, where am I? Oh, we're doing all right. In 1915, they were able to go back to the United States for Christmas, and they went to Due West, South Carolina, where they had family. While they were there, her husband became ill. He had dizzy spells, and by New Year's, he was bedridden, and by January 6th, he had died. So this sort of marked a time in her life when she thought she might not go back to China. And nobody thought she would go. Everybody thought she would stay there with her daughters. But she finally decided that she needed to return. She always would go back, no matter what. So she needed to return, not only to complete her own work, but to complete some of the work that her husband Mark was doing. And she says in one of her quotations, many visitors came to see and express their sadness. She says, all of them talked about Mr. Greer and wept when they knew that he would not return. It was beautiful to hear them talk. Don't tell me that the Chinese are cold and unsympathetic, which I thought was really nice. They were able then to build a church as a memorial to him. And here, so in 1916 he died. There that is. And then building a church as a memorial in 1918, there's a photograph of the church, and you can see that there's quite a collection of people now. So there were many, many Chinese Christians at this point, even though it was not always a popular thing to do. She herself was loved by the people and respected as a physician. She had 6 furloughs to the United States, but something of the joy with which people welcomed her back is seen in this quote from one of the nurses. They said, you don't know how much people love and respect Dr. Greer. When she goes on furlough, often sick people come to the hospital and say, I want to see Dr. Greer. And so they say, well, you can't. She's gone to America and won't be back for another year. And the person says, well, I'll just wait until she returns and then I'll come back. They say, well, no need to wait. Here's another doctor. Here's this fine Chinese doctor. She can treat you. And they say, oh, no, I'll just wait a year until Dr. Greer comes back, and then I'll bring my sickness to her to look-see. So she was very special in their minds, and she was not only a very competent physician, but she was also a very loving and caring person. I have one more story. There's still time. Okay. One more story about her being willing to do really whatever it takes in order to help. And this comes from the notes that Eric provided from the Presbyterian Historical Society. The person writes, I shall never forget the time when Dr. Greer and I went to see a Japanese major to plead for the lives and release of our 4 beloved pastors who had been arrested and imprisoned. Dr. Greer, who understood the Oriental mind, got down on her knees on the floor and began to kowtow or beat her head on the floor before the major as she pleaded for her boys. Even the hard heart of this Japanese officer was touched as he lifted her to her feet, and shortly after that, the pastors were released. So this just gives you a sense of her her determination, her spunk, her faithfulness to the people and to her church, and to her God. Just to give you a sense of what she did in a day, this is a typical day. She, of course, cared for the patients in the hospital. She ran daily out clinics with patients with specialized diseases. She went out into the country for patients too ill to be moved. She held clinics in those remote areas. She kept the accounts and the records. She settled the fussing around between staff members. She entertained visitors, and she maintained her home with 3 small children. So it's little wonder she was tired and was known to say that one more step would crack her back in 2. But then she also says, Yesterday and this morning, as I sat in the hospital chapel with the women and girls all around me, listening so eagerly to every word of the old story, I felt that mine was a wonderful privilege. And I think that just starts to show her heart. Presbyterian Historical Society has this record for one of the years. In 1 year, she did 13,657 eye treatments, 352 surgeries, 531 hospital patients, not all at once, I'm assuming, and 132 outcalls. The outcalls, I have a quote on that just to give you a sense of what that was like. Again, reading from my Glorious Living book here. Dr. Greer's idea of a holiday, whenever she can make arrangements for her hospital work to be carried on in her absence, is to take a trip to the country to hold a clinic. A memorial gift by a woman in North Carolina, Mrs. John A. Tate, has made possible the carrying on of such medical extension work by our hospital in Suchelfu. Come, let us take you on a ride, for the like of which you have never known, as we pile into the back seat of the running board of the Ford given to Dr. Greer by friends in Georgia and North Carolina, and shake over the terrible ruts to some faraway market town on a medical evangelistic tour. And there you can live with us in the mud-walled, thatch-roofed shack for 2 or 3 days while you watch Dr. Nettie Greer in action. Here is a man with bleared red eyes. Here is a baby with great open sores on its head. Here is a man in the last stages of tuberculosis. And here is a beggar covered with the itch. Here comes a poor fellow with elephantiasis dragging a leg nearly as large as the rest of his body. And there on a bench, crowded against the other patients, is a leper. Some of these she treats at once. Some are sent to the hospital for treatment. And those beyond treatment, she tries to cheer. The Chinese equivalent of gangway is now shouted, and through the clearing come 4 men carrying an old door on which is lying the pale form of a young man who was wounded by bandits last night. A plaster and flour paste and earth packed into the wound has stopped the bleeding. Had Dr. Greer not been here today, surely this lad would have died. And there in the midst of these wrecks of humanity sits this little silver-haired woman with a stethoscope, a penetrating smile full of sympathy. And though there may be 100 cases to treat today, she refuses to be rushed, but listens to each one pour out his or her tale of woe. And then she tells of him who can change sorrow into joy. So I love that. I think it's just tells about her heart. I have 2 other quotations that I think give a sense of her dedication to the people and how she viewed them. The first one is on poverty. Old women who had hobbled on bound feet from long distances, many of them were oh so dirty. Much of the filth was not of their choosing, but of their poverty. Who would not be dirty if he had to wear the same garment day and night for half a year because they are too poor to buy a change of clothing or to buy a bit of fuel to heat water to wash? On cleanliness, they know little of sanitation, but we dare not fuss too much lest we cause them to dislike our gospel and estimate its value by our actions. We are here to win them and not drive them away just because they might be dirty or do not see things from our point of view. I just thought those are wonderful insights. And there's lots of awful stories about missionaries degrading people by their treatment and so forth. But this woman, I think, just had such a warm heart and loved the Chinese people to the extent where she at great cost to herself, served them. She retired in 1937. So here she is retired, and we have completed our story. The writer of the Glorious Living book says that he knows that she has a secret, or had a secret. He said, over her desk hung a small sign with a familiar verse. And you, I know, have seen this. Only one life will soon be passed. only what's done for Christ will last. So that's Nettie Greer's story. So I don't know if you have questions or comments or, yes.
She lived a long life.
She
died when she was in her 60s. She died when she was 90.
Yes, 95.
What did she do in the last years of her life?
Well, she returned when she got to be too old and too frail, really, to be in China because it was physically demanding. She went back to the United States and she taught and led classes at Montreat, which I think is that in North Carolina?
North Carolina.
Okay.
Like
so it's like a conference center there, yeah. So she went there and worked as long as she was able until she was too old to do that. As I said, she had three daughters. One of the stories I read said how wonderful it was to see her at Christmas time because she would have all of her family there and all of the visitors and her three lovely daughters, one of whom actually went and joined her. So her daughter, I think it was her middle daughter, went and joined her in China to work with her. So anyway, yeah, so that's what she did. So I think she stayed there until she felt that it was physically too difficult and maybe too dangerous. And at that time, I mean, I'm not sure you could get like a life flight out, so like you can now. Other questions? Dawn.
A couple of reactions. Fascinating report. You did a lot of work. Thank you.
Oh, it was fun.
Interesting that when she was sent as a single woman.
Yes. It was, I think, but there was a collection of four or five people that went together. But she was single, and she didn't get married until she'd been there 3 years. So.
And she must have learned the language.
She did, yes. I think I left that part out. But yes, when she first arrived, there's a story that the only thing she knew how to say was "Wo Pu Tung," which means "I do not understand." And the Chinese people would ask her questions, like, "What's your name?" And she'd say, "I don't understand, you know. How old are you?" And they wondered, how could she possibly be a doctor if she doesn't even know what her name is? But then, of course, eventually she became fluent, yes, and she was able to talk with the people. I don't know about the writing part, but she was able to speak with them, yes. And she didn't know any. And I don't know that, I mean, nowadays I wonder if when people go on mission abroad, I have a feeling that they get some language training, but I don't think she got any. She got her medical training, and that was pretty much it.
No. Where, you know, maybe most people either go to church or identify. But the church in China is doing quite well, and a lot of that is historical. Mm-hmm. The fact that people like Greer. Fantasy that has been passed down through generations.
Yeah, she did that. That's true. And I forgot what I was going to say. Well, anyway, yes, I think you're right. I think that's true. I know what I was going to say. I think there was mixed feeling in China about the missionaries because I think they recognized it as a reasonable religion, but then they started to feel like people were getting in there and taking their land. And so then they reacted against the missionaries. I don't think they were reacting against Christianity. I think they were reacting against being in what they viewed as being invaded. So I think there was pressure put on them, but they stayed, and I guess there's still people there. So.
As I understand it, and we've had people from this church over to China, it's more of a tolerance. It's not accepting. It's not persecution of Christians or of the church. And the church is, as they would say, is underground. But underground doesn't mean that they're being actively pursued.
Well, I think, though, the fact that they had helping things, they helped. You know, they treated people with medical capabilities that maybe the Chinese people didn't have. And so, in a way, it's sort of like when we go to Haiti and, you know, we're heard because we can help. That's a really a quite different thing, though, because there are a lot of Christians, and it's and we're welcomed and loved, and there's no problem like there is in China. But I think the fact that they're medical, they also ran schools. They had one of the things that her husband did was to start a boys' school, and so these kinds of things where they give, and it's partly that you see the message of Jesus in their lives, and so it becomes visible to them. It's not so much like, you know, we're going to make you believe this, but we believe this, and this is how it makes us behave, so we hope you will join us. This is sort of, I got that feeling from the things I read from her. I felt a very warm feeling toward her. I don't know that.
I don't know. It's not a big percentage, but it's
5%.
Probably more than that.
Because that's 10% to build with a lot of people.
There was a young lady from this church that went over there to teach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, as you said, what they're really fascinated, people have not been exposed maybe to Western culture. Our whole Christmas, what is Christmas? Why is Christmas so? So then you can talk about why Christmas culturally, historically, is significant to us. But you couldn't talk about Jesus per se, but you can talk about, well, that's when Jesus was. We saw
Well, and I think they lived it. They lived the Christian life in a sort of a visible way. And the fact that they are there in pretty miserable conditions without, I mean, they weren't doing it to make money, you know, so it has to carry some weight with the local people that, you know, a person who could be sitting happily at home in their warm house in the United States with every comfort ends up living in a mud hut and, you know, living a life that's really a sacrificial one. So that has to carry some weight. I think people pay attention then, and especially when they're willing to help with medical or education. Those seem to be the two places where missionaries are involved. Other questions? Comments? Okay, well, you get an early out. You can go get a coffee and see you in church. Thank you.